Welcome to Wine, Women, and Song. I'm the host, J. Austin Bittner. Here with me today are my wife, Paige Stroop, Zoe Johnstone Stewart, Jessica Hanel Sadaba, and Catherine Davis Jenkins. We are most of the core of this group. I'll ask them to identify themselves by voice in a little bit. We are listening right now to Johann Strauss' waltz, Wein, Weib und Gesang. Very appropriate. Yeah, that was a surprise to most of these ladies. I'm being the first podcast, I'm going to say a little bit about why this, because... Well, I love wine, women, and song, but also because when I grew up as a kid, I had strong, intelligent, witty mother and sister, grandmothers, aunts, cousins, and when I went off to school and started my young adult life, I tended to surround myself with those types of women, and two of the earliest influences on me when I was a singer were Mary Agopian, my second voice teacher, and Joan Mattelli, who was another strong female, vibrant personality and fabulous artist. And I have always valued that female voice when it came to music. But as I listen to all the shows that are out there about music, that talk about what they're hearing and what they're interpreting or what they're feeling about what they've heard and how the playing was, yada, 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 yada. It's almost all men. And I thought it would be wonderful to have a format that emphasized the female voice. And so I will always, every podcast, surround myself with more women than men present. I should point out that we are in our home here, and we call it the Spy House and Zoo, and that's because we have two dogs and two cats. And so throughout the podcast, you may occasionally hear them participating or them making themselves known by doing something else. But we're going to embrace that, just like we embrace life. And overall, that's kind of what this whole thing is about, is embracing life. And now this time I want to go around and just, you know, have each of the ladies say a simple thing about themselves, just so you can identify their voices throughout the podcast. So just start by saying your name so our listeners know who you are.
I'm Paige Stroop, Jay's wife, and I like wine and chocolate.
Amen.
I am Zoe Johnstone Stewart. I am a guitarist and educator, and mostly of children, but of many others, and perform in a guitar quartet, and also enjoy wine and chocolate.
Damn, I should have had chocolate. Okay,
chocolate's next, right? That's what, yeah. So, I'm Jessica Sataba. I'm a soprano, and I hope I represent the soprano tribe well.
I'm sure you will.
But I also enjoy wine and chocolate and potatoes, and really especially also pasta.
Yeah.
But we're not eating pasta right now, so
next time,
off topic.
I am Catherine Davis Jenkins. I am a mezzo-soprano, so we are having two sides of the female singer coin here. Yes, I like wine and chocolate, but who doesn't? And probably, my name is Catherine, not Catherine. That gets a little weird, but the reason is because my parents are Welsh, and it's the Welsh form of Catherine. So if you hear me banging on about Welsh stuff, that's why.
Awesome. Well, I should point out that we here, besides being an emphasis of, you know, singers, we're not going to talk technically, for the most part, about what we hear and listen to. We're going to talk about most of the other stuff. We look forward to tasting wine, listening to music together. And tonight, I want to point out that the wines we're going to be tasting are all rosés. And the other element to this is that we're tasting all of these wines blind. So none of us know what we're drinking until the big reveal at the end.
Woo-hoo.
So with that, we have all been sipping on the rosé number one, which I think is kind of lovely. Feel free to say anything you want about the wine at any point, but we will have a structured discussion later. And so with that, I say we give a toast and we begin.
Cheers.
Wow, that is timing.
Like we planned it.
Nice. All right, so our first selection we will listen to now, and here we go.
And we're not supposed to say that it was our selection, right?
Right, no, we'll talk okay. Afterwards.
Talk after.
Thank you.
like, yes, totally introduced me to music I don't know.
I really love.
I am so glad that that just got played. That is such a fabulous piece.
So what is it? I don't know. Everybody else seems to know.
It's Zeffiro Torna by Monteverdi.
Oh, see, I love Monteverdi. No wonder. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I've never heard
this was my choice, and I chuckled when it played because Jessica, this was the processional for my wedding, and Jessica was one of the lucky sopranos that...
I've not heard it before. I
really had to work on my color term for that one.
The color tour is really clean.
It's
on
so
this
beautiful,
too.
Though. They do such a great job. And the thing is, like, one of those people is a countertenor, right? It's Philippe Jaruski.
Yeah. Mm,
and okay. So I think I was actually the countertenor at your wedding. And our other friend
awesome.
Was the other one.
Yeah.
Soprano. But no, it was. It's just. It's a secular piece, right? It's not really.
Yeah, it's about springtime. Like,
I was gonna say, it sounds like spring.
Yeah, it's about like welcome spring, Zephyr, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's also kind of a like a almost a joke with like as far as sort of really over the top text painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this was a kind of good example of that. So. That's another like part of its importance, but I think this is really cool too. I mean, I'm gonna be—I don't know—I really like early music, and I really like that style of singing. And I just—I've always kind of—I don't know very much about early music.
Mm-hmm.
I being a classical guitarist, like you do have to be very aware of sort of, you know, the history of the lute and early guitar, and
mm-hmm.
read that kind of tablature and all that stuff. But
know, my brother Walt, lutenist, early musician, etc., and
yeah.
And I actually did some, way out of my league recording with him years and years ago. Maybe I'll dig that up someday. But and he opened this world of music up to me. And actually, like, why did I ever think this was a good fit? But because of his, you know, exuberance for it and how much energy is. I mean, that's one of these things. Like, there's so much energy in this kind of music.
There's so much rhythmic, like, pulse.
Yeah.
So much fun. It's like, I feel like it has so many, modern pop music and this, like, I mean,
right.
You can get just, I mean, you can dance to this easily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It made
so
me join the
fun.
Renaissance Ensemble at Peabody. With me.
Renaissance Ensemble at Peabody.
Yes. And believe me, that was like trying to fit like the rectangular peg in the like pinhole hole. But, but regardless, I stuck it out for a year, but the main thing I got out of it was a love for that kind of music and an utmost respect for how much work goes into that music, because a lot of times there's freedom to it, but there's also like this work you do to figure out, you know, what was done, what was the practice, whatever. But then there's like this freedom of, well, but you can kind of make it up within those parameters. Like once you know what the rules are, you can play around so much more than you can with some of the conventions that we have with our more, you know,
what's
modern
is what you do.
Music.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So Zoe, I have to ask, did you choose this because you were like, it'd be fun, it's for my wedding, I'm going to do it. And who, that's my one first question. And then the second question is, can you tell us who the actual singers were or the ensemble?
The ensemble, I forget who, so it's
Philippe Jaruski.
Yes,
is,
and I forget who the woman is, because it's,
I do too. I
it's
feel bad
Nina
about
something.
That.
I'll look it up. So
Nina.
It's one of these albums I bought on iTunes, and they don't really, like, there's no cover art.
Is Christina Pulhar?
Well, she is actually the director of the ensemble, and she plays the theorbo, which,
okay.
For the listeners that don't know what a theorbo is,
yes,
it's this crazy lute-like instrument that's huge. Like, if you've ever seen, like, you've probably seen, like, pictures on, like, Christmas cards and stuff of, like, angels playing lutes.
It's like the John Holmes of lutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is this sort of pear-shaped, like, pluck-string instrument that has, like, a fancy sound hole and, you know, a headstock that kind of folds back. But a theorbo is this giant instrument, like many feet tall, that has lots of strings. And anyway, so Christina Pulhar is the one who runs the ensemble, and she plays
the
theorbo.
That's why she's on the credits.
Right. So it's her, this is her, you know, album.
Cool.
Is it
all
she's
Monteverdi?
Not the singer. It's all Monteverdi.
Oh.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Fun.
But this, I think, is not a very, like this is a kind of crazy recording, because it's not a very, it's purist, it's not very purist. There's lots of, you know, it does sound like a pop. I mean, that's probably, like, part of why I like it so much, because it does really sound like a pop song.
Yeah, it starts off and you're like, wait, what is this? And they start singing and you're like, wait, this is early music.
Yeah. So, yeah, but I just think it's really, I think it is kind of cool how, like, early music, like, it used to be something that I think was seen as, like, very stodgy, because it was so, you really need to have so much scholarship to kind of understand it, and now I think people are starting to kind of get into it so much and kind of building on all the research that's been done, and now they're kind of starting to, like, come up with these new sort of fresh ideas and takes on it, and that, I think this is an example of that, so, yeah.
I love it.
And it's just so beautiful and so well done, and I really like it very much.
Well, yes. And it was fun to hear it again, because I haven't heard it, thank you, Jay, since the wedding.
Yeah.
And of course, in the wedding, it was a very different interpretation, mm-hmm. not the least of which, because a countertenor was not singing it.
Right? Maybe that's why I didn't recognize it. Jessica's not a countertenor.
But also, I mean, I love the interplay between the two voices mm-hmm. there. I mean, it was a very tight sound, and they really matched each other beautifully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, this clearly was something that was incredibly well rehearsed. And again, whether you like straight tone or not, you have to admire sort of the artistry and the ensemble, but again, at your wedding, it sounded so very different, not least of which, there was different orchestration, saying that in quotes, and the two voices were much more, again, a sound with vibrato, and so it's really interesting to hear a piece reinterpreted so many times and enjoy it in both versions.
Well, we could talk more about this, but... in the essence of time, we should move on to our second selection.
Fair enough.
I agree with everything, with so much what was said here. The last thing I want to say is one of the things I was impressed with was all the clean transitions in and out of modes
yes.
and keys. It was just really wonderful.
It took so long to get to the B section.
Right.
It did.
Yeah. It was almost a shock, which I'm sure was the point. Anyway.
And we moved on to our second
one.
And
we have moved on to the second one as well.
Okay.
That's true.
Ooh.
All right.
Indeed. Mm. I can't smell, but that's all right.
Limoncello.
Lin Manchella thought that was a lullaby.
I yelled at him, and he ran in and laid on my lap and fell asleep. It was the most amazing thing.
Lin Manchella is a cat, everybody. Yes, yes, in case you're wondering.
Just clearing that up for the non-visual participants.
Right. Is a cat who thinks he's a lion. Yes. And clearly the music has soothed the savage beast, because now he's asleep on Jay's lap. So that was mine. Go figure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, tell us. I think I have a hunch who it is. Tell me
guess.
Who it is. No, I'm embarrassed.
Guess.
I'm a soprano. I think it's Regine Crespo. Oh.
It's actually Janet Baker.
What?
Yes.
She sounds so non-English in this.
I know.
Wow, she sounds so, like, free and...
Yeah.
How wonderful.
So that is Dame Janet Baker singing part of Berlioz's Nuit d'Été, which is a six-song cycle. This is the second song in the cycle. It's Le Spectre de la Rose. The cycle was actually composed for piano, but then that was, I think, in like 1841, and then was Berlioz orchestrated it, and I think that first was performed in 1856. This is a live performance, which is very different from what we just heard, obviously, as a
I like it. I love the energy a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And and that's from the 70s. And I cannot remember who the orchestra was. This is actually on, it's on YouTube. So
it's on the internet.
It's on the interwebs, indeed. Interwebs. So if you wanted to see Dame Janet tearing it up, it's half the fun sometimes.
I just read her memoir called Full Circle.
Okay.
And it was I think it was actually not ghostwritten. I think she actually wrote it. And it's in the form of a diary. She talks about the years that she's getting ready to retire from opera, where she started to sing only concert rep. So she was like, I'm done with opera. I'm just going to start singing concert rep and oratorio and that sort of thing, because that's what she really cared about. So I'm wondering where this fell in, like, that. Maybe it was just after she had... But the book about her was unbelievable. You haven't read it.
I have not read it.
You can borrow it. It's
fabulous. I would love to. But yeah, I just think she's such an extraordinary interpreter of music. Mm. And as Zoe mentioned in the last piece we listened to, just sort of word painting, text painting. And I think that's what this artist really excels at. I mean, there's such emotion behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And the poetry is basically about... It's told from the perspective of a rose, indeed, as you do in romantic poetry, of
rose, yes.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Perfect. I love it.
All comes together.
So it's from the perspective of a rose that has been cut for essentially a corsage that a young girl wears to her first ball, or a ball, I don't know if it's her first ball, and now... The rose is singing about how his or its life has not been lived in vain, because it's had this wonderful experience and is now dying, but dying on the breast of a beautiful woman.
Oh my!
Yeah, it's,
oh my.
Well, again,
damn straight.
That's right.
It really goes with the whole thing.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, like, one of the things I was thinking is, like, you know, when she went into her lower register, for me, that was like, that's the definition of sultry without being sexy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was looked at, I mean, and really clean, everything, just an amazing tone throughout. There was no section that seemed off the breath or thing that sometimes people do when they try to get really
precious.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And whenever she
yes.
was getting gentle and narrowing it down, it was still always there,
the
you know, because it was very focused.
Yes,
it was
absolutely.
Just stunning.
Yeah. And the thing about these recordings too, from like the 70s and, you know, pretty much pre now, is that it's just the person actually sang it. It's live. It's exactly how it's not edited. From what I've heard, I was talking to a recording engineer, that today's classical music recordings have at least 150 edits per track. Wow.
Oh, so yeah. I don't.
They're barely.
Have you recorded a CD recently? Like,
I wasn't aware of that. I was like really floored by it. So what we're hearing is not anything like
that. Well, you remember when I was at Peabody, or you don't remember because you came after me. When I was at Peabody, I had a little side business because I had a mini disc recorder, which was a digital recorder. And I would record because it would make an awesome recording, better than a cassette to send off to, you know, your young artist programs and whatnot. I had a little side business where I charged to record me for these. But even with that little thing, and I couch it with, I have integrity, I'm not going to do a lot of edits or anything. Well, I really didn't know how to do a bunch of edits. But I did do things where, like, there would be times where, like, in time, sometimes you'd have, like, a recitative and there's a little pause and a gap in an aria. Sometimes I would just, you might have an audition page that went out and nobody would know, and it was actually two separate takes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because they would have sung the recitative and gone right on and sung the aria, and it was like glorious, and they go, I screwed up the words or whatever, and I was like, well, we'll just go back and do the recitative. And that's me not knowing shit and having a little, like, you know, mini disc recorder, like the size of, I don't know, you know, two packs of cards or something. So I can't imagine what they actually do in a studio.
Yeah. Well, people, I mean, it's, I there's a whole, I mean, this is sort of off topic, but yeah.
No, it's no, not. It's not. Part
well,
of it is the beauty of the live recording.
It's true. Yeah. And it's, it, yeah. But I mean, I think people, like, you know, recordings have changed the way we perform, and we listen to things differently now than we did before, you know, before editing was so ubiquitous. Like, now, I mean, there's such a perfectionism that's in technique that's emphasized in musicians' training that really wasn't there, you know, when recording was just getting started. I mean, you know, this is many years ago, but I mean, as we kind of get further, as technology kind of increases, it really does change performing. But yeah, I mean, the expectation is that it has to be, like, perfect.
Because that's what everyone hears on TV.
But you know what? I'm listening to that, and it has, and we'll hear more clicks and pops as the you know, podcast goes on. But, I mean, you still just get this warmth that's there.
Yes,
that,
absolutely.
That even with the earlier recording, forget about the whiteness of sound. It was so clean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just because it was a studio recording, and that, it just, the whole presentation, it just felt more like a hug.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, so good.
I like it.
I'm a big Janet Baker fan, obviously, because I chose this. But I do think, you know, she in her career, I mean, there was very little she didn't do. I mean, she was one of those artists that, you know, she had a relationship, a professional relationship with Benjamin Britten and his works, you know, Berlioz. I mean, she was in Le Troyen. She was Dido in Le Troyen, and she was also in quite a few times. She was known for that. And a bunch of other Berlioz works. You know, she also did a lot of Monteverdi. So here we go. We have the early music, we have the Romantics, and then we have Benjamin Britten. And, you know, I think she really managed, I mean, she was such a talent. And during that time, you were able to do all of those types of music and not have anyone say, you're an early music singer, you do new music.
Right.
Or,
so that's really more of this is Zoe, I'm not a singer. So this is, so that's more of a newer thing that people are like, this is your... I don't even know
people think of your voice as like being, and I'm not wrong, they're not wrong in one sense, like it's a unique instrument from person to person, so, but they try to pigeonhole that you can only sing one way with your voice and do one type and style, whereas, like, I mean, if a piece is written for guitar, you presume to, if you're a guitarist, why couldn't you do any of it as long as you learn how to do it properly? It's like, you know, if you're a dancer, nobody bats an eye if you have the training and can actually do flamenco and can actually do ballet and can actually do, you know, modern. If you do it well, nobody says, oh, well, you know, you're really a ballet dancer. No, they just say, bravo, brava, you know?
Yeah.
I will say, sorry, just add a caveat to that. She, to my knowledge, did not do Verdi or Wagner.
Oh, fair enough.
But that's... But,
whatever.
And again, and I'm not...
She did a lot of Handel, too, right?
Yeah, she did a lot of Handel.
I don't know. I think that the niche thing has really arisen because there's so many singers. And so we each want to try to find something that we can really, really do well and shine instead of trying to be.
Sure. Yeah.
But it looks like you would like to play another track.
Oh, another track.
Yeah, another track.
Looks like
Mr.
J is ready for more
Rose
wine and more
tracks.
I think this is Jess's.
Thank you.
obviously live recording, which is one of the things I love about it. The person who claps and gets shushed. I mean, how fabulous is that?
Pretty awesome.
But this opera is just so unbelievable, in my opinion, because there's so many fabulous moments like this where, for me at least, and I feel like there's two kinds of things that in arias. Like, there's two kinds of arias. The arias that move the story forward, and then there's the arias where time just stops. And this aria, in my opinion, is one of those moments where time, like, just totally stops. She's having this moment, this beautiful evening. And Susanna is this sad person who really, I mean, I feel like she never really did anything wrong except to be, like, really beautiful and was victimized for that.
And naive.
She, right, she was naive, she was ignorant, yeah. She didn't know any better. And it's just such a, it's a very relevant story for, like, any era. But Phyllis Curtin, she has those mezzo, like, low notes that are so beautiful. I just think it's unbelievable. And how she just cuts through the orchestra in the top with no sense of muscular singing. I mean, it is just absolutely bright. It's free. There's none of that, like, Wagnerian sound, although you can hear that she could sing over any orchestra that she wanted to, right? But it's just so bright and beautiful. And then after singing that huge high note, super loud, she drops down and has plenty of presence in the bottom, and I just think it's so gorgeous. And
well, it's funny, you know, you say you know, the, you love this whole work.
Yes.
This is, like, one of my least favorite Carlo Foy operas.
I was about to say, should we say what it is?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
We haven't actually said that it is Susanna by Carlo Foy.
Yes, and it's Ain't It a Pretty Night. It's a very, very frequently accepted aria.
And this is the best part of it, in my opinion. And it's got great moments, but as an opera, I don't like it. It's like, I feel like it doesn't have
love
flow.
It.
I love it, too.
Love it.
But,
and
so
why don't you like it?
Fine.
Why don't you like it? Let's hear this.
I just feel it doesn't have a good, it has good dramatic flow. I don't think it has good musical flow. I think it's not his
best.
And it's of Carlisle Floyd's works. Like, I think some of his other operas are better. I wish some of his other operas were performed more than this one. This one is, like, performed all the time. I would much rather hear Of Mice and Men. I would much rather hear Wuthering Heights.
I gotcha. Okay.
I just think they're better works. But it sounds like, I mean, I love this aria, and I love, you know, I know I love Blitch's. I mean, there are things I love, but as a work, I just don't think it flows as well as the others. That's my criticism. It's not that it's bad. It's not. It's just not my favorite of his.
I've never seen it, so I can't really comment.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen it, Zoe?
No.
Yeah.
No, I have not.
What
Fair
did
enough.
You think, though? Did you feel like, is this the first time either of you have heard the aria?
I think I've heard parts of the aria before.
I recognized it just going to... So my husband, Andrew, is a pianist who does a lot of accompanying, and he's definitely accompanying people singing this song.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
he definitely
sure.
has.
Definitely. So I was like,
not
oh, it's
well.
The song. I was like, oh, my. Like, I don't remember.
Not singing it this well either.
Sorry, Andrew students.
It's really hard. It's a really hard aria. It has those huge octave leaps. It has the low, it has the high, it has everything, and it's really
perfect. It has really, really big moments, obviously, coming
in,
and then it has these very intimate moments. I mean, like that last part, I mean, like, that's the joy pain you want to hear in a voice.
Absolutely, she has it all. And you know, I don't know, how many of you had Italian, well, Catherine and I know had Italian diction with John McLucas, and he studied with Phyllis Curtin. So I feel like we have a very direct connection to her. I think she's still alive.
She is.
Yes.
As is Dame Janet, by the way.
Dame Janet is still alive.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, not singing. Neither of them singing anymore, but still.
And you know, Catherine, I was thinking, I said, oh, she doesn't sound British at all. Like, that's a bad thing. I don't know. It just sounded so French.
Well, no, but you
so
don't.
That's a good sign, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so that's good. So I have to... See, I'm going
to
get myself in trouble on
you
this podcast.
Third, yeah,
I need
third
to have part. Another rosé, don't I?
Well, you have to taste the third before
oh,
we talk
for heaven's
about
sake.
It.
Okay.
But I do think with, I mean, this aria, I remember I had the very good fortune to travel to St. Petersburg, Russia, when I was a student at Peabody, and with three other singers, a soprano, a tenor, and a baritone. And the soprano was a very talented young woman named Christine Cavanaugh. I don't know if Christine is still singing, but she used to sing the heck out of this aria.
I bet she did.
And it is often sung really, really badly.
Yes.
But she sang it beautifully, and we were in Russia, and the first half of our concert was all Russian, which is terrifying, by the way, to sing Russian to the Russians. And then the second half of our concert was to sing American works. Mm-hmm. And she sang
that was
this.
With Vera Danchenko Stern, right?
It was indeed. And what I think is fascinating is that in Russia, if they really like you, once you finish, everyone starts to applaud. And then within the first 15 seconds, probably 10 actually, now that I'm thinking about it, they all start to go from a cacophony of different rhythms of clapping into one solid, the whole audience just claps in rhythm.
How
and
cool.
That is like the equivalent of a standing ovation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's really fascinating, but I will tell you, when Christine sang that, it happened every time. The rest of us, not so much. it's a great aria when it's done well.
Yes.
Oh, sure. I mean, because it has so much, and you know, I honestly can understand why, especially for women, why it's so. What you said at the beginning about it being transcendent of time, women feel that place in their lives often where they're trying to assert themselves. They're in a vulnerable position. They feel taken advantage of. You know, all things that happened to Susanna in that opera.
I do think that one of the things that's really interesting about opera singing is that often, because voices mature at a different rate than, you know, well, anyway. we're often singing characters that are much younger than we are.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, Susanna is a young girl. And I think that, oddly enough, it's really best sung by a woman who's had a little experience in life and can really, like, see who she is from the other side.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the reasons why Phyllis Curtin just sings it with so much depth.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, we have to move on, but one thing I want to say is, like, one of the joys I have had about putting together this podcast. Dude, get down!
Michelle's going for
the
food
again. We have
the
cat situation.
It's like, this week on Monday, you know, while the club was closed, I was recording all these, or ripping the ones I had to, which were, and I listened to them, turned up in my office, and like, this one, literally, I was like, I started listening to it, I was like, walked out of my office, I'm like, yeah, it's recording, it's great, and I'm like, all of a sudden, like, I got about 10 steps away, I just had to stop. It was just... It just so grabbed me, I'm not familiar with Phyllis Curtin. I'm not familiar with, you know.
I believe she.
You know, Dame Janet. So, I appreciate you guys introducing me.
I believe she premiered the role. Correct. Okay.
I think it was written. It might not have been.
Let's just say she premiered. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh.
No. Sorry.
What happened?
Anyway.
This isn't the other piece?
No. The other piece. It was playing and I didn't realize it.
Oh, dear.
So now we delve into what the section I like to call En Route to the Dump. This is because I'm going to try to tell this story briefly, but in 2009, the Baltimore Opera Company declared bankruptcy, and I was present at the bankruptcy auction for various reasons. But one of the roles I ended up playing was that when the archives of the company were being sold to the Peabody Conservatory for preservation, I was the one transporting all of those archives from the musty, moldy, humid, damp, dank, stanky, whatever you want to call it, basement of their warehouse. And I took all these things in my car to the Peabody, and when I got there, they said, oh, we only want, like, the photographic albums, and we only want the music that's been on CD or DVD digitally. We don't have the resources, time, money, etc., to transfer anything that's not already been digitized. So the rest of it was supposed to go to the dump. And I did not have it in the heart to just throw it in the dump. So I've decided
to prolong its trip to the dump. And so this is actually first use of things before they get dumped.
The spy house basement.
Via the spy house basement, that's right.
Yeah.
Where they're residing. And so these recordings, not been well preserved in any way, shape, or form, because, again, I have less resources than those who were supposed to partake of it. But so I've decided that at this point we will hear an excerpt from one of those recordings. And I'm not going to tell anybody what the excerpt is until after we're through, but I will say that because it hasn't been preserved as we're listening, and as you're listening, I ask that you forgive the sometimes as long as 5, maybe even 10 seconds of extreme distortion that's in the recording. This is live, obviously, but it's not a produced recording and not a well-preserved recording, so I beg your forgiveness of those things as we listen to this.
On the way to the dump.
On the way to the dump.
On the way to the dump. She knows what it is.
I'm getting a read on it. I don't want to embarrass myself like I did this Regine Grossman.
No. Should we know this singer? Should we?
I
think
you should not know the singer.
That's right.
But you probably should know the piece.
Oh, God. Okay.
I have no clue.
What if I told you it was normally sung not in English?
English. Yeah.
Thank you.
first black.
Oh, yes, excellent.
Bravo!
Bravo! So I think we need to apologize to who, whatever singer that was just singing her little heart out just then. If you are still with us.
We're laughing at the recording.
Indeed.
Not the
singer. You were amazing.
Actually, really listening to the quality of the voice, I'm very impressed.
Yeah,
violoncello.
I do know who the singer is. Does anybody know what the excerpt was from, or take a guess?
Will you give us?
Well, okay. I gave you a hint earlier. It was sung in English. It's not written in English.
It is usually sung in
Russian.
It's Onegin, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the letter.
That's Aria. The letter seen in Aria.
Dude, I really should have.
Why on earth did they choose to do it in English?
I have no idea. Well, now this is a recording from 1980.
Okay.
Wow.
March 22nd, 1980. And the soprano is Heather Thompson, who I had never heard of before, but you can go online and look her up, and she had a great career.
Mm.
Sang a lot. Sang of the Met. Not premiered. Her first singing of this role, I want to say, was at, I forget now, so I'm not even going to say. But yeah, it was someplace I was like, oh, wow. So I love the sound of her voice when it's not being distorted by the damage of the recording.
She sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So thank you, Miss Thompson.
Yeah, definitely. you said, is it a name? You know, it's not a name, but... Why do you need a name?
You need
a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I started earlier than the aria with that little good night and the being able to, was because I thought maybe that would give you a hint as to the scene to come. Did that give you a hint?
It gave me a hint, yes. And I have to say, though, it was funny because I thought, like, oh, this is one of the Russians. I think this is Onegin. I think this is the letter scene. But what was so funny is I don't know at that time who was playing for the Baltimore Opera. For many years, it was the BSO. Forgive me if it was the BSO. Forgive me to whomever was playing that. It didn't sound particularly Russian to me.
No forgiveness. The only part that sounded Russian to me was the French horn when it came about half to two-thirds of the way through with the wonderful motif. That sounded... I mean, that was not just... The theme sounded Russian, but it sounded like a Russian, timbre.
It had the right emotion.
Right, the right gravitas.
And maybe because, and again, as a singer, I am predisposed to listen to the singer as opposed to the instrumentalists, forgive me, but that's the truth. And because she's singing in English, that is a real... disconnect for me when it's repertoire that I think is so very tied to its nationality.
Yeah.
Or nationality is such a tough word to use. Ethnicity is as well. But you know what I mean? That sort of feeling behind it.
Well, it's like anything. I mean, like, even, any poetry, literature... if it's translated, it's not the same emphasis. The words aren't the same. It's a translation. And so, there is a disconnect. But maybe that was a disconnect in terms of recognizing it. And I thought about not using it. And I mean, here's the thing. I mean, like, to record these, I have to, like, I don't listen to them as I'm recording them. I record them and then I listen to them.
Sure.
I was like, whoosh, it's in English, which in one sense helped me to figure out exactly where to clip because I could get an English translation and find it because I'm not Russian. But I was like, it's important to do because it shows what they did back then. I didn't know they would have performed this in English back then.
No.
In the 80s?
Yeah.
I went to college, in the late 80s, early 90s, and everything I heard, this is like a decade or maybe a little less later, was no, it's always should be sung, in the language it was written.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though my teacher, when I lived at the beginning, Mary Agopian, she talked about how in Germany they would do it all in German, but she had said that practice had changed. So I was surprised, very surprised. But I thought,
I thought that was something people did in the 50s.
There
like,
you
I
go.
I feel that was like, yeah, know, like right? a much earlier thing to
Does
do.
Does anybody know someone who's around from those days in the Baltimore Opera and might know? I think
well, you know what Mike Rowe?
Yes. Mike Rowe also, yes, but more importantly,
Mike Rowe.
Mr. James Hart.
Ah,
yeah. Certainly knows.
Around then?
So,
know.
Yeah. Well, we make sure he listens to this day.
Yeah.
Well,
we can
ask him. But no, it's very discordant. I think, well, sorry, on so many levels, but I think it is discordant to hear. There still, of course, is a practice where operetta is sung in the language of the vernacular of whatever country you're in. So even if it was composed in German, if it's in this country, it'd be sung in English. Not so much with opera. Because opera is... For example, if you were to take La Traviata and not have titles, surtitles above it, or just even have someone singing da-da-dee-dee-doo-doo-doo, not actually singing the words, opera is driven by the music.
Mm-hmm.
It is not text-based. It is driven by what the music is doing. Now, the text is very important. But I still believe you would be able to hear La Traviata and see La Traviata, and even if they were saying nonsense syllables, if they were trying to tell the story, they would still be able to tell the story, for the most part, with the music. The music
informs.
Well,
that's why Carrie Taccomo works. Because when she messes up the words, it doesn't matter. It's still the music.
Hilarious.
I love her voice and love her singing, but you know
oh,
what I'm
saying.
Oh,
you're talking about that Met Gala thing where she... Screwed up Tove Sano.
Well, right. And of course, there's the famous Robert Merrill saying Di Provenza, you know, and kept singing the first, you know, seven or eight words.
We've all been there, Jay.
Right. I can tell plenty of stories about singing the wrong words. But you're right. In some sense, there are many fewer instances in opera where the singer gets to text paint. Like we heard
in even
the orchestrated art song,
yes,
and you know, and the text painting you talked about, you know, in the Monteverdi, you don't have
Zoe.
As many operas
mm-hmm.
That have instances where you get to do that. It's so much is dictated by what is written in the score that it is communicated regardless of the text. The text helps or should help tell the story.
I want to hear what okay. Zoe, I'm totally putting you on the spot. This is really
do it. I
want to hear, like, besides your clip, which was absolutely fabulous, what stood out to you the most of the others that you heard? Like, what spoke to you the most?
Well, I really like the song, the Ain't It a Pretty Night.
Yeah.
Because I like that piece. I mean, I just think the piece was, like, very
so
profound.
Good.
And it was really... And the performance was very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it was very, I mean, it was really very convincing and very powerful and really well done. I will also say in the piece that Katrin brought too,
Berlioz.
Yeah, the that last like the ending part where she has that very covered sound in her voice and it kind of really. I think just that, like the other piece was more sort of my style, but that one, I thought that was like really moving too. I don't know. I mean, I don't really listen to a lot of vocal music, and I definitely don't listen to a lot of opera.
No, but that's why your
and
perspective is
so.
Awesome.
I think for me, like what tends to stand out is these sort of like dramatic changes in color or dramatic, you know,
sure.
emotional. Like where it's probably like really pounding over the head. Like that would be something that you know, people that are more versed in the style would kind of pick up more easily. But for me,
no, not. I mean,
not
that's
more
this
easily.
Is
not
yeah.
That's the
like,
moment
no.
that I found really powerful and really, really
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Well,
How about you, Paige?
Which was my favorite?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean. Well, probably the Monteverdi. it's wonderful. And I love Monteverdi anyway, but I mean, usually I've only sung like his choral work stuff. So you know, which is good, but, you know, it's different. And it was like, I couldn't remember that that was from your wedding, because it was kind of different, and I'd only heard it that one time.
It was it was kind of like 6 years ago.
But yeah, so definitely the Monteverdi piece was my favorite. I mean, I love the opera pieces too, or then the Berlioz, but yeah.
I do like just the nice symmetry of that Susanna in Ain't It a Pretty Night and Tatiana in Onegin are both sort of innocents.
Yeah,
and again, we did not choose these in conjunction with each other, but and Tatiana is older at that point, but it's still these sort of young women who are sort of taken unawares by what life has thrown their way.
Yeah.
Well, I screwed up, of course. First podcast, I was going to make a mistake. We were supposed to talk about the wines before the Baltimore Opera. I noticed there are a couple empty glasses, mm-hmm. so. We'll start talking about wines 1, 2, and 3, but what wines out of 1, 2, and 3 can I get those with empty glasses?
Can I have number 2?
Number 2. Please?
Number 2 for me.
Number 2 for you.
Number 1, please.
Number 1.
Right.
If there's any 2 left.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
there is, sure. Great.
No.
Wow, nobody liked number 3.
Well,
no,
I did
okay.
like 3.
I liked 3.
Well, we'll start with number 1, which was what you wanted,
mm-hmm.
Zoe, right? Okay.
Yes.
So what did we think about number 1?
I liked number 1. It was on the sweeter side for me, which I know some rosés can be like just a tad bit sweet. But I liked it. I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as the other.
See, number 3 was the sweetest for me.
Really?
It was the peachiest. I just tasted number 3
okay.
and I was like,
peach. Number 1 was the sweetest for me.
Funny.
Maybe it was just because the peach was so overwhelming. And
yeah.
and sorry to our listening audience, I have a severe cold, so all of my tasting notes could be way off the reservation, is all I'm going to say.
Oh my gosh.
So you talk about sweet. You said there was like peach. What about aromas between 1, 2, and 3? Did you notice? I mean, Catherine, you're handicapped with your cold.
I'm excused.
I mean, I noticed that the third one had like the most grassy and floral notes, and the second one had like a barnyard kind of like smell to it, like a hay and
minerally.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a little more acidic. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
I love that little bite that it has.
The little bite.
So much.
That yeah, and it's got that bite on the palate. Definitely mm-hmm. number 2 is.
Yeah,
and I thought number 3, I mean, number 1, the aromas were kind of muted. They were very present.
I would
present.
Agree. They were fruity, but not...
Yeah, I'm not getting
But it's not like... It wasn't like... by muted, I mean, they were present, just, it would, you know...
Quiet.
And we are drinking these, and well, except for Jay, we're all drinking these out of proper rosé glasses, which is why the stem is pink. So is it like the Riedel...
So
rosé
what's
very
fancy. Why is the stem supposed to be pink?
well,
these are
that's
pink.
So interesting.
Well, not
it's
necessarily.
Not supposed to
this
be
was
pink,
marketing
right?
because when Riedel did their rosé ones, they released them during October, so Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So they decided to make them pink since everything is pink at that point. In
okay,
time. But no, but so but I like to mention that.
But
yeah,
yes,
no,
these are
the
rosé glasses.
But, I mean, and, well, you know, I don't want to get in, but the wine glass really does make a difference. As much as I love wine, I really didn't believe that malarkey until I went to a tasting about it. So it really does. So,
Can you take a picture of it and put it on the blog?
Yeah,
we'll
take
a picture.
There you go.
With the cat.
There you go, with the cat.
A cat and rosé.
But,
rosé glass, so.
I mean, one of the reasons I love rosés, and rosés actually in the last 4 or 5 years have been making a real comeback.
Yeah.
I think. Dry rosés, which are these are, you say sweetness, but none of these have any residual sugars.
No.
But they
but
sweetness in terms of they taste like ripe fruit when they have a fruit flavor. And one of the reasons I love rosés is because it introduces red fruit flavors into a white wine, which normally in white wines you don't get berries like raspberry or strawberry and cherry in a white wine. And it really introduces those, which is wonderful. And the other thing I love about these is for this time of year, spring, summer, they're very refreshing. They take on kind of a lemonade-esque quality with a sweet, sour, tart thing. Not like they are lemonade, but that balance between the two. And you say that acidic bite, that's just like some people love fresh-squeezed lemonade because it has that power.
Yeah, number two reminds me a lot of like a very French-style rosé.
Okay.
Like that.
I gotcha.
It's very French in that it's like very clean, very acidic, but still has some of the fruit on it.
I love it.
So, do you want to find out what the wines are?
Yeah, let's tell us.
Big reveal.
All right, and then we'll talk a little bit about like then besides just revealing what they are. So, in the essence of not unwrapping all the foil off of them, number one is 2014 Charles and Charles Rosé from Columbia Valley, Washington.
Ah, okay.
So this is a project of a joint project between Charles Smith and Charles Beeler, who's from Perry of Phils. And Charles Smith is like a, I'm going to sit on a cat. So Charles Smith is like a rock star of wine right now. And this is really interesting because this is like a super blend, meaning like there's five different grapes in it.
That's number one.
How funny.
I had that the other night and I loved it.
No. This is Charles and Charles.
Oh,
yeah,
Charles
and Charles. Smith.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Sorry.
Vino. This is Charles. This is different. So.
Different. Okay.
I think it's still lovely, but it was not my favorite either.
Yeah.
And it's primarily Syrah, 72%, and then it has less than 10% each of Mourvèdre, Cabernet Sauvignon, Grenache, Cessol and Cunois. So,
okay.
It really interesting wine, but oh well, and $10.
Really?
Well, it was on sale. I think it's normally like $12 or $13, but where I went, like almost all the rosés are on sale. I'll tell you guys all where later. I just don't want to give a plug. Unless they started giving me wine, but yeah, I mean, like, and, well, I mean, I think I've said at least to one, well, at least to Paige, and she's heard me say many times. One of the reasons I love rosés is I think they're often great bargains because even though they've been coming back the last 4 or 5 years, there's still not a giant market for rosés compared to other wines, so they typically have to sell. And when winemakers make them, they tend to make them not because they think they're going to make money. They make them because they love rosés.
Right.
So they tend to be a little better wine across the board of the whole category.
Well, I certainly liked one. I just liked two better.
Yeah, I would agree.
No, and that's fine.
But I like them all.
That's like, you know, exactly. All right, so number two, which apparently most of you liked.
More.
Yeah. Liked more, right, is Saintsbury. This is 2012, so this has been sitting down in my cellar for a couple years. This is a Vangrie of Carneros Pinot Noir. So this is 100% Pinot Noir in number two.
Carneros, that's out of California?
Yes, okay. In the Carneros region, which spans between Sonoma and Napa valleys there down in the south of the two valleys. I've had Saintsbury wines before, but this is my first Pinot Noir from them. And I thought it was great, wonderful. It was, you know, really well balanced. I think it was actually a little more acidic than the other two.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
And but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a very
really
refreshing
good.
Thing.
Yes, I love that.
We're having right now here very cool Memorial Day weekend. Normally Memorial Day weekend people think of hot in the beginning of summer, which this kind of wine would be perfect for, I think it's really interesting that this one has like strawberry and like spiciness, kind of like a blood orange spiciness to it.
I do smell the strawberry thing.
But there you go.
Yeah.
So I really like this one. Mm-hmm. It's a good one, and we bought this in a basket at a wine auction. So I really don't know how much it retails for, but
good
I'm sure it. I'm sure because it's from Saintsbury, it's probably somewhere retails usually around the 20 mark, just knowing their price range.
Gotcha.
But it might be on sale.
You
know?
never know.
The 12. So the 14 is the recent release, so sorry if it's not as good, Jessica.
Oh, jeez.
Right, I know. Que sera, sera. Okay, so the third wine was Jean-Luc Colombo Cape Bleu Rosé from Provence, France.
I really love that one too, actually. Okay. I loved the third one.
I thought the third one had one of the like best noses.
Really?
The grassy and the floral,
that's
very kind of perfumey.
Maybe your palate is
Maybe
off.
My palate is off.
But and Provence is like very storied region for rosé. In fact, like what is it like? What's the famous actress? Brad Pitt.
Angelina
right.
Jolie and Brad Pitt have their winery in Provence.
And then
well,
some major like rosé or whatever that's like been well reviewed
like
and blah blah blah.
Mirabelle, or, I don't know. It's actually good. We had some.
It's good, but I mean,
it's not
30
fat.
Bucks
it's
good.
Not,
I
no,
mean, like
it's riding on their name for sure.
Right,
but it's good.
But this is a little, usually like around $13 a bottle. So again, not that expensive. I've had other vintages. I hadn't had the 14 before tonight, and it's really nice. I personally, you're gonna love this, Catherine. I'm looking on it, and they say aromas, subtle hints of peach.
Subtle, my fanny. I'm not trapped with that thing.
When was the last time anyone actually said the word fanny?
Oh, I love the word
it's
fanny.
It's really so great.
Indeed.
It's so much more delicate than
well, indeed,
the other
but
words.
If this podcast...
I was say in this country,
I was gonna say, if this podcast goes to the UK, I've just really set the world alight with that comment. But anyway, it's all right.
Is fanny really bad in the UK?
Yes, it is.
Well, I certainly think we're approaching the... We're pushing the 90-minute mark here on our podcast, and maybe we went a little long in the tooth. I don't know. Maybe this will be the average length of a podcast.
Who knows?
But I want to encourage all the listeners to try some rosés. I personally think if you like white wines, they're actually a great thing to have in the spring and the summer. And we also invite you to enjoy life and embrace song. And as we leave, we're going to end all of our podcasts. We heard earlier there was a choice here from tonight, or from Zoe and Jessica and Catherine. But we didn't hear a song from Paige. And actually what we're going to do is have one of our ladies close each podcast with a choice of song that is not classically trained voice. So I'll let Paige introduce the song and we'll play out and we might chat over it. We might not. And that'll end our evening.
All right, well, this song is by one of my favorite female artists, who's like a kind of a folk artist. Sadly, she has left us way too early, in my opinion. Eva Cassidy. Mm-hmm. And this song is I Know You by Heart. And I think it's just one of my favorites because it's sad, but it's very romantic. And it's a song that used to come up on my playlist when I was like relaxing in the bath and kind of chilling, so it I don't know, I really like it a lot, so I thought it would be a good non-classically trained voice for us to listen to.